they encounter. This book was super helpful to me, and it is a book written by a woman named Laura Vandernoot Lipsky, and she is Buddhist. So some of her ideas and ways to fix things come from a very Buddhist perspective. So as I read it, I wanted to like think through also like how does this show up as people of faith, as people who trust in Jesus. And this session kind of came out of bringing those things together. So a lot of the research is hers. She both has worked in a lot of nonprofits and then interviewed people from all over the country who work in nonprofits, both those who are managing their trauma exposure well and those who burnt out and quit and got exhausted. And so I loved the book. I saw my own story show up in it a bunch of times. This was on like page one and was one of the first times where I was like, yeah, that's true of me. Or she said, my exposure to other people's trauma had changed me on a fundamental level. That she's telling the story where she was on a vacation with her family, standing on this beautiful vista overlooking the ocean, and she turns to her husband and says, I wonder how many people have jumped off this cliff. And her husband said, that's not normal, my dear. And she's just realizing that her exposure and her life had changed the way she encountered the world. And that's true of me too, that I am present in the world in a different way than before I started my work at One Hope, fresh out of college. And I think that some of that change has been like that where I see the worst of circumstances and situations in ways I shouldn't, but some of it has been so much for the better. That the ways I show up in the world are more empathetic, and I see the image of God in people more clearly, and see parts of God's character that I wouldn't have seen if I hadn't done this work. And so while this exposure has changed me, I think more of the change has been for the better than for the worse. But here's what we're gonna do today. We're gonna start off by talking about why trauma stewardship, why this term. The bulk of our time is gonna be spent on the 16 warning signs of trauma exposure. Then we're gonna talk about how change has to come from the inside out. And then the last part is her kind of path forward. She calls finding your way. And we're gonna kind of talk about that, compare it with some Christian ideas about finding our way. So firstly, why trauma stewardship? The question that she asked again in the first couple pages of the book that really resonated with me is, how do you stay in touch with a heart that is breaking? Because as you lean into the lives of people who are experiencing trauma, and as you love them, their cares become your cares, and the things that break their hearts break yours. And then the more people you meet, the more your heart breaks and breaks and breaks and breaks. Mm-hmm. And different people have different capacities for that, but everyone's going to come to the end of their capacity for that. And then what do? For the temptation is to just put a wall up and distance yourself from your heart and just do the work with your brain. But it's necessary for ourselves and for the people we serve to stay in touch with our heart, even when it's breaking, even when it feels like it's too painful to do that. And so the question we're gonna try to answer is, how can we do that? How do we do that? Trauma stewardship is a term that this researcher, last name is so long, Vandernoot Lipsky, I sometimes just call her Laura, I'm sorry. but she looked at research around compassion fatigue, secondary trauma, stress disorder, vicarious traumatization, empathic strain, secondary trauma, all ways that people talk about this experience of working with people who are traumatized and feeling some of the effects of that trauma. And she calls it then trauma exposure response, is what she kind of sums all those things up as. And then what we do with it is trauma stewardship. And it has three different parts. Trauma stewardship means how we come to do this work, like why it is we're showing up to love people in these ways and in these places. It means how we are affected by this work, the toll that it takes on our hearts and on our brains and on our bodies. And then how we make sense of and learn from those experiences. So trauma stewardship kind of covers all of that. And I really like the word stewardship because it reminds me that it's something that it's my job to constantly take care of, right? A steward is somebody who like takes care of and manages things. And as I encounter trauma, I need to be a steward who's constantly like managing and taking care of how that's affecting me and showing up for me. So the 16 warning signs you guys have on your handout. I did not give you a lot of space to take notes on each of them, but you can use the back or whatever, or I can send you my slides afterward, or you can read the book. But we're gonna go through them. And if you need me to expound more, let me know, but there's a lot of them and I have a lot to say, so I'm gonna kind of move fast. The first one is feeling helpless and hopeless. It's when you don't think that anything you do can be effective or enough. And the perceptions that contribute to that is, the first one is holding yourself personally responsible for a situation where you think, I'm the one who has to fix this. I'm the one who has the mandate or the education or the power or whatever, but I have to personally care for and fix this situation. Another perception that contributes is when you don't see a possibility of relief, where the problems are too big. I've experienced this in a lot of ways. I many times would leave my work at One Hope on a day where I had like had a really intense encounter with a kid and learned more about their trauma and their history in a way that weighed on me. And then I would drive through Tulsa to wherever I was going, and I would look at house after house after house after house and be like, how many kids in this city are carrying the same weight? And it would overwhelm me. I would see no possibility of relief. Like, there's no way we could help all of them. And just not seeing a way for relief to come. Or a third perception that contributes is believing you are likely to repeat current struggles in another place or time. We kind of talked about this in the homelessness session, a little bit of like, you help somebody deal with drugs and alcohol, but you have this reservation of, well, I've helped them for now, but they're probably gonna fall back into it. I'm just believing that it's just gonna keep going and we're gonna keep having this problem. The next one is the sense that you can never do enough. This sense comes from a scarcity mindset where you kind of are not sure if you could ever be strong enough, smart enough, helpful enough, caring enough, that there's not enough of you to go around to meet the problem, which the reality of that is there isn't, right? There's not enough of you to go around. But there's enough of God. There's enough of Jesus. And we have to counter that scarcity mindset with a reminder of the abundance that he is. But then what the sense of urgency, or the sense you can never do enough does for us, is it puts us in a place of urgency where we just feel like we have to fix everything now, and we're constantly like spinning and trying to be enough and do enough, and that destroys your pace and your balance when you succumb to that sense of urgency that comes with the sense you can never do enough. Another one is hypervigilance. So I kind of have a little chart here where the green one shows like how your nervous system is supposed to operate. This is not very scientific, but just a visual. But where your nervous system is trying to regulate between your body and your brain as you experience sensations, your body responds to them. Your body responds to like an intense moment with adrenaline or to a joyful moment with serotonin, and it like spikes you up, and then your body regulates and is trying to bring you back to the middle all the time. So you can see the green one is like experiencing a high and the body brings it back to the middle, and then there's a little low and the body brings it back. So this is how our nervous system is supposed to operate, where we're coming back to the middle. But when you have things happen in your life that overwhelm and flood, one of the things that can happen is that people get stuck in a state of hyperarousal, this orange one, where you never actually come back down from anything. Your body is always on edge and always on alert, and the smallest thing can set you off because your body is just staying in this heightened state all the time. We'll talk about the numbness one later too, but those are both part of it. And technology actually increases this for us because it lets us always be on. We can always know about more traumas and about more things that are going on, and somebody could call us in the middle of the night, and we're so accessible both to people in our lives and accessible just to the traumas of the world. Like, how many times have I gotten off a long day of dealing with children's trauma to scroll Twitter and see all of the trauma that happened in the world that day too? And just that hypervigilance, always seeing the worst. The next one is diminished creativity. And as an art teacher, this one is particularly like puts my antenna up. But what trauma does is it makes us crave the predictable. We want things to be normal, predictable, and that's one of the ways we support people in trauma. But as we work with people in trauma, it's really important to have the ability to be creative in how you support and help them. But creativity requires a certain amount of chaos. If you come in my art classroom, you know that. It requires leaps of faith. And it requires a willingness to embrace change. All of those things are a little unpredictable. And so when you're overwhelmed with trauma, you back away from creativity. But what do we lose when creativity decreases? We lose a lot of the impact we could have when we're coming up with creative solutions for things. So the art teacher me can't help but leave you guys with that question. How can you intentionally make space for creativity so that you're not allowing it to be diminished? Another one is the inability to embrace complexity. So when we encounter these terrible things, one of the things we want to do is just draw a clear line. This is good, this is bad, this is right, this is wrong. And we feel this urgent need to change sides. We jump to that side, we get really dogmatic and opinionated about our side. Our knee-jerk response to things is no. And then the outcome of that is that it can cause like gossip and cliques and rigid expectations in workplaces or nonprofits where people are taking sides really quickly and really strongly and not leaning into the nuance of what the other people's position might be and where you're making assumptions and passing judgments too quickly. One of the things that happens with this is that sometimes in our hurry to vilify and address a problem, we create other problems because we didn't really understand the complexity of the problem we were facing. An example of this she shares in the book is in the 80s and 90s when the domestic violence problem really came to the forefront. A lot of people were addressing it, and they did a really intense criminalization of domestic violence, which feels so good, right? These people are abusing other people, like they need to be put in jail. But all of the focus and energy of that movement then got put on criminalization and not on restorative practices. And then it also created this problem where women would be in these relationships. The man would say, if I get convicted of this, I'm in jail for 10 years, I'm in, for however long this is. And this woman loves this man and doesn't want him to necessarily experience that. And so it put another barrier between victims of domestic violence actually accessing the resources they needed because they were afraid of what would happen to their partner that they loved. And so while the people doing this felt like they really fixed the problem, they created some other ones by not understanding how complex the domestic violence situation is. Another one is the act of minimizing, where you see so many things that are so wrong and so bad that small problems are just like, you just wash them away. You're like, oh, you couldn't get your kid into the school you wanted? Well, I know this family of six that's homeless and they're like not in any school. And just every problem, like you have a worse story for. And so, what happens then is it's hard to engage our empathy. We lose our empathy practice because we're not having empathy for these smaller situations. And then it gets to where it has to be the worst of the worst for our empathy to even kick in. And it becomes a factor in negative organizational culture where the only problems addressed in your organization are the worst ones. And everyone's trying to one-up each other with like, well, my problem is worse because of da-da-da-da-da. Well, my problem is worse because of da-da-da-da-da. And your organization then becomes like kind of combative and competitive in trying to find the worst problems. A caveat that this is not triaging or prioritizing. Those are things you have to do in the work. You have to sometimes drop everything for a more urgent problem. That's triaging. You have to set priorities as an organization, as a culture, as a person. But that's different than minimizing, and you have to maintain that distinction. Another one, chronic exhaustion. probably resonates for people. Chronic exhaustion leads to physical ailments where your body is under stress, it's not getting enough sleep, and when you get enough sleep, you don't feel like you've gotten enough rest. And that stress can cause other health problems further down the road. Bessel van der Kolk is famous for saying the body keeps the score. It does for the traumatized and for those who serve the traumatized, that if you're always in this state of hyperarousal or active and your body never comes down and is at rest, you get into a state of chronic exhaustion. And then one of the things that comes out of that is a sense of obligation, that your culture kind of becomes like, we're all exhausted. We all just are tired, and it becomes like, if you're not tired, what's wrong with you? Like, maybe you're not doing enough. This next one, I've got a little cartoon for you guys, deliberate avoidance. The guy's saying, no, Thursday's out. How about never? Is never good for you? This is when the best thing that can happen is for somebody to cancel something on your schedule. Your phone rings and you're like, I can't pick that up. You're just trying to avoid your life as much as possible. You only have bandwidth to hang out with people who get it, like your friends who aren't in trauma work. You're like, I don't know if I can go and just like watch a movie with them. They don't get what I'm going through. Those are all signs of deliberate avoidance. Next one, dissociative moments. Dissociative moments are actually something that our body uses as a mechanism for protection, that when things are too overwhelming or too intrusive, that our brain goes nope and just moves ya. And it's extremely common for those who have personal history associated with the work they do, that something that they encounter is such a strong trigger to past memories that they dissociate. And having dissociative moments is another strong indication that your trauma exposure response is too high. Sense of persecution. Sometimes when it feels like your work isn't going anywhere and you can't figure out why, then you try to put it on outside sources. And so that lack of efficacy, that feeling like it's not working, then you say, I'm being persecuted somehow. There's forces working against me. And a lot of times that sense of persecution becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, where if you walk around and run around with a chip on your shoulder, well, then you kind of become a target. But nobody actually needs to be persecuting you for this to occur. You can just kind of feel like things aren't going right because everything's against me. Everyone's against me. No one cares about this the way I care about it. And a really powerful story that she shared, she talked about how inner strength comes from choosing to be powerful, even in the face of persecution. She shared a really dramatic story about a Holocaust survivor who they asked, how did he survive the concentration camps when everything about his personhood and his dignity got stripped away? And he said, it really didn't. Like, I had a choice every morning if I was going to lead with my left foot or my right, and if I was going to talk to the person on my right or my left on our work line. And he maintained his dignity by maintaining his sense of free will and the choices that he still had. And I just loved like how much he experienced the most intense form of persecution and yet maintained his dignity in that. And that helped carry him in a way that he was less broken by that experience. These next ones are super, super common. Guilt, maybe the strongest sign of a trauma exposure response. But what this often looks like is when you purposefully diminish yourself. When anything that is going right in your life, anything that's nice or beautiful or happy in your life, you feel a sense of guilt associated with it, and you don't share it with the people that you're serving because of that guilt of feeling like their family's so bad. Why would I share that I had a happy lunch with my family? That their life is so hard and I got to get away to a cabin this weekend and felt really refreshed. And you feel this guilt for the good things in your life that then means you don't share them and you hide who you really are. And then what ultimately actually ends up happening is you begin to experience less abundance and joy, that even you're in those moments, you're away at a cabin and you're just thinking about all the people that don't have that chance for that joy. And that guilt is overcoming that moment, so you can't even enjoy the moment you're in. Another one, anger and cynicism. Oh, fear. got my notes a little out of order. Fear is a natural and healthy response to much of what we witness. When you see all the hurt that the world can give, fear is a normal emotion to have in response to that. And yet, as Dune says, fear is the mind killer. And what it does is it destroys your ability to encounter the world in an open way, that you're always looking for the trauma to come. You're always trying to protect yourself, and that protection then makes you selfish, and it makes you fearful of connection and of relationship, and makes you constantly anxious. And so your mind is just focused on this sense of protection rather than any kind of reaching outside of yourself. Denial is a form of this because it protects us from feeling vulnerable. But one of the things that we know as believers is that fear, while it's natural and not wrong, we also have a God who tells us not to fear. And one of the big reasons for that is because what a lot of our fears are, when we like break them down and dig into them, is it's ultimately a fear of death. That when you get to the end of fears, like, my fear is that I will die. But we know that we'll die. And we also know that death is not the worst thing that will happen to us. Like Paul says, if I depart and be with Christ, that's far better. And so we know we'll die. We don't have to live in fear of that. How do I want to live knowing that that will happen? What kind of person do I want to be? What kind of life do I want to lead? Knowing that the worst thing I have to fear actually doesn't have power over me. Anger and cynicism is the next one. Again, another emotion that is probably right in the face of a lot of what you see. God is angry at a lot of what's happening and a lot of the ways people are being traumatized and oppressed. But our anger undealt with is really damaging to us. So anger can look a couple ways. It can be hot and reactive or cold and slow. There's a lot of rigid socialization around anger from childhood, that a lot of times men are socialized that like anger is the only safe emotion to show, and that showing sadness or other emotions would make you less of a man. But women and people of color are often socialized to not show anger because anger is stigmatized when it shows up in people of color or women. And so we have to kind of break through that socialization and just be like, anger is just an emotion. We all experience it. And then ask somebody that you trust, tell me about my anger. And then listen to them with an open heart. What does my anger do to those around me? What does my anger feel like for you, for other people? Because when we don't process our anger, it gets taken out on the people and situations and animals around us that aren't connected. And so oftentimes, like, the people we love are bearing the brunt of that in ways they shouldn't have to. And so we need to know. Yes?
Real quick, can you repeat those questions to ask them?
Tell me about my anger. What does it look like? How does it show up? What does it feel like for you and for the people around me when I'm angry? And listen for what that is with an open heart, not defensively. It doesn't seem easy to get defensive about that. Cynicism is related. It's a coping method for dealing with anger. Moving on, I said we'd get back to numbing. Here it is. Numbing is another result of when your system's overwhelmed by stimuli. You can stay in like that hyperarousal, or your system can just shut down and numb out. It can often show up as like drinking or drugs, like using outside sources to numb, or it can show up as numbing yourself through overwork or overscheduling. It can show up as numbing through technology and just work a really hard and intense day or have a really hard and intense conversation, and I come home and watch 4 hours of Netflix and go to bed. And Thomas Merton has a quote here that I really loved in response to that numbing through overwork or overscheduling. He talks about how the frenzy of our activism neutralizes our work for peace. It destroys our own inner capacity for peace. It destroys the fruitfulness of our own work because it kills the root of inner wisdom, which makes work fruitful. So while it can feel like we're getting more done when we numb out through overwork, what Merton really puts his finger on is that we're actually destroying what really makes our work fruitful when we are numbing out through overwork. That leads to addictions. Addiction is when you have an attachment so strong it persists despite your understanding of its potentially destructive nature. You can think of like the big ones like drugs and alcohol and sex. Addictions we often overlook are addictions to overwork or to a productivity-based identity. Those can also be things that we are so attached to, even though we know overwork can destroy you, does destroy family relationships, friend relationships. We'll dig into this a little bit more, but one of the antidotes is equanimity, having the space within for everything, where addictions are like an extreme form of numbing out because you feel like you don't have the space. You have to make space for everything. And last one, finally, grandiosity. What it is, an overinflated sense of one's importance related to one's work, where you kind of believe like, I have to do this because I'm the one who's gonna save this. I'm the one who's gonna make this right. I'm the one who's gonna fix this. And your work becomes the center of your identity. And what happens when we live in that space of grandiosity is it can keep people in the work longer than is best for them and those they serve, where their sense is like, I'm the one who's gonna fix this. And even when it's time for them to like let someone else do that work, they don't give it up. And it can cause a loss of perspective on outside relationships or your personal life. We're unique in America in that we place our identity so much in the work we do. The US is, we ask the first question, what do you do? And that's not how the rest of the world operates. The rest of the world, our first question would be, how's your family? Where do you live? Kind of more community-based questions, and our identity is in our doing. And so that's part of where grandiosity comes from. So we made it. Any clarifying questions before we move on?
Are any of these like more of a red flag than others? Or are they all
red flags? They're all red flags. We're not going to minimize any of them. There are certainly ones that are more common than others, but I found as I went through the list, I'm like, I've had moments of all of these, and I know the ones that are more common for me.
I just retired from the fire department last year. I spent 30 years on the Tulsa Fire Department, and we had a group of us guys, we had a firefighter Bible study. When you were going through here, I could think of a verse for almost every one of your things, you know.
Yeah.
But and so we started that, a group of us, because what you just said, everything you said, we saw stuff that we didn't process very well, and blah, blah, blah. And so what always, the attendance would go from 10 to 15 guys, we met every other week, but it was always guys and gals, they're at the end of my career, we had a lot of female firefighters, that we're in a bad place. They would reach out, and so in that community and fellowship. So, and that's all I would try to do is just point them to the word, because the word has a
scripture. Yeah, the word has something to say about every single one of those. Yeah, that's true. And that's kind of why, a little bit of why I put this question here. When my trauma responses take over, when that's where I'm living, how does that impact my relationship with God? And how does that impact my relationship with people? What is that doing to both of those relationships? And I'd love to pause there more, but I have way more to say than we get to. So one of the things she says is that change has to happen from the inside out, and I fully agree. I just do it a little differently. She's Buddhist. But I decided to go to a passage that has held me many times when ministry is really hard, and it's actually 2 Corinthians 4. We don't have time to dig into the whole thing, but it starts by Paul saying, therefore, since we have this ministry, therefore, since through God's mercy we have received this ministry, we do not lose heart. And that is such a guiding word for me, that the ministry that I have, that I'm doing, whether it's in my job, whether it's through my church, through groups that I'm leading, through just people that I love who've experienced hard things, God gave me that mercy, that ministry, by His mercy. And His mercy gave it to me. His mercy will meet me new each day for it. His mercy will carry me through, and His mercy is what will help these people. And so that means I don't have to lose heart, that I can trust the mercy of God. It's been shown over and over again to be what I need and to be enough for me. Verse 7 says, "But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us." Just a reminder of who I am, that I am just an average jar made out of clay. And God is the one who has the power to do this work and is doing it through me. And then the next couple of verses just come back to time and again, because I've experienced it, but I also pray it, because I know what it's like to be hard-pressed on every side, and I pray that I'll not be crushed. I know what it's like to be perplexed. I pray that it won't put me in despair. I know what it's like to be persecuted, but I pray that I will not be abandoned, that I know I'm not abandoned, because we're not abandoned, but sometimes we don't believe it. Even when I'm struck down, I'll remember I'm not destroyed. There's so much good in here, but going to the very end here. "Therefore, we do not lose heart." Back to how we started. We don't lose heart because outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. That change that she talks about from the inside out, we have the real hope for that. We know that God is inwardly renewing us day by day. "For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal weight of glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. Since what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal." We see a lot in this work. We see a lot of pain. We see a lot. And whenever that feels overwhelming, we have to fix our eyes on what is unseen, on the truth that God is going to make all things new, that Jesus died to purchase the resurrection of all things, the redemption of all things, and that we have that hope to share with the world, that this unseen hope, this unseen God, has a real tangible effect on what is seen. And we get to be part of that as we work with these people. Running out of time, one of the things she talks about is wholeheartedness, the ability to be present and to show up with all of yourself. This is a biblical idea, and I think also speaks to our question at the beginning, that when our heart is breaking, we want to like partition it, or we want to wall it. And the Bible talks about, the psalmist praying, "Unite my heart to fear your name." Paul talks about how if we enter into any kind of work, even the most intense kind of martyrdom, and we don't have love, we're not bringing our whole heart into it, we're not gaining anything. And then the last section here is called Finding Your Way. And she talks about, this is her path forward. Again, she's Buddhist, so... the core of her path forward is daily centering. That's kind of what I just talked about, of daily remembering the mercies of God are new every morning. This mercy put me in ministry. Daily getting up and reminding yourself of who God is for you, for the people you're meeting, and taking that moment to refocus, to have that balance, that presence. And then there's a lot of help and practical wisdom in her other four directions. So I'm going to dig into those a little bit. The first one is inquiry. Inquiry is kind of asking, like, why am I doing what I'm doing? Having like a purpose statement of reason that you're coming back to this work, knowing what that is, having people in your life who also know what that is so they can help remind you of it when you've forgotten. Another important part of inquiry is making sure you're attending to your original trauma. So many people are in the work of serving traumatized people because they have trauma in their lives, and that's such a beautiful and good thing. The depth that they can bring to those relationships and to that work is amazing, but if they're not attending to their own trauma, then their past trauma will compound and re-traumatize. And so just really being honest about what you're doing with your original trauma as you work with people who are traumatized. And then even just asking, does this work for me? Is this thing that I'm doing still actually, like, not just effective for the people around me, but is it effective for me? Am I living into my calling? Am I living my gifts? How does it work for me? Why? Why is it matching up with, like, who God made me to be? Obviously, she didn't say that, but. Next one is the focus. What do I pay attention to? And when you encounter a tough situation or a tough day, she talks about, like, reframing strategies. And this is something that has been super helpful for me in my work as an educator, that I can come to an end of the day and just remember all the times, like, the kids didn't listen to me and a kid fell apart and I dealt with behavior issues. Or I can pay attention to the kids that grew and learned and told me a funny joke and told me they loved me. And when I pay more attention to the good, it helps me deal with the bad. And so remembering, like, to put your focus on things that will help you and that are positive, and ultimately, like, paying attention to the work that God is doing. God is always at work, and when we pay attention to the work God is doing, then it helps us to enter into that work with joy. Another part of focus is, it may seem like an anti-focus, but it's knowing what your plan B is. If I wasn't doing this, what would I be doing? And that can seem like a bad idea, like, especially if you're, like, the leader of a nonprofit, you're like, I don't want the people thinking about a plan B. But when you have a plan B that's like an actual feasible plan, that means you're choosing the work you're doing. That plan A is plan A, and you're doing it because it's A, not because you have no other options. And so actually having a plan B is an important thing to have. Next one is community. How does my circle, how do the people close to me nurture hopefulness, accountability, integrity? Who am I keeping close to me and why? And do they know me well enough to actually do those things for me? Mm-hmm. And then am I seeing myself and others with compassion? She uses compassion. I often think of grace. Do I see my own mistakes through the lens of grace and know even when I mess up that God will redeem it? And do I see everyone else through the lens of grace too and know that God is still working on them and I have hope for them to be better in the future than they are now because I know God is perfecting them? And then last one here, balance. How do I rest? How do I deal with the physical aspects of trauma? One of the things she brought up that was really interesting to me is that sometimes when we experience secondary trauma or things like that, our trauma nervous system gets activated. Our fight or flight kicks in. But then we don't do anything with it. We don't actually fight. We don't actually flee. And so then our body is in this state of arousal that we haven't worked through. And that's part of where the trauma comes from. And so paying attention to your body as you come into these things with your mind and your heart and are wholehearted, paying attention to, am I caring for the needs of my body? If I had that fight or flight activated, do I need to do some deep breathing? Do I need to go run? Do I need to go work out? What do I need to do to work through this bodily thing that my body's trying to have a place for this adrenaline to go? I need an outlet for that. And then am I practicing gratitude, which is a very Christian thing. You know, we're supposed to give thanks in all circumstances. And there's always ways God is working that we can remember and recount and be grateful for. So like I said, a lot of wisdom there. I also have found wisdom in, they call it the contemplative tradition. This is from Renovare, which is a spiritual direction program. And one of the things they've done is they've identified that Christianity kind of has six large streams of faith. And that each, like, denomination or movement has certain things they focus on. So my background is evangelical, and this is, like, the stream that I'm really strong in, the word-centered, like, knowing the Bible, preaching the Bible, sharing the gospel, grace through word and action, the life-giving message of the word. That's like the evangelical stream. But there are also other streams of faith where you can encounter God and grow that are very important, and maybe a place where you need to read a book from somebody you haven't read or experience a different style of prayer, things like that. that could help you. You know, sometimes it feels like I've gotten to the end of what God is teaching me here, which is never actually true, but maybe you just need to come at it from a different angle. And so I appreciate how they talk about how there's so much in each tradition. The sacramental is the tradition that really honors like the act of taking communion and how that reminds us of God's like physical work, and that our spirits and our bodies need to be united, and God gives us something physical to remind us of that. And so even just in the taking of communion, you can lean into that tradition and like think about the physical body of Christ and how does the breaking of his physical body impact the brokenness you see around you and the way that you show up for those broken and the way that you deal with your own brokenness, just having that. So recommend looking into that if that intrigues you at all. But this last part, if you don't have a plan for how to deal with your trauma, you can't do your work. That's something she said. Greg Boyle, who works with Homey Ministries and gangs in LA, he said, if you don't make friends with your wound, then you can't show up for the wounded, either yourself or those around you, which is so good. And so we need to kind of make friends with our wound, as Father Boyle puts it, where we are really familiar with our most common signals of trauma exposure. We know what that looks like, how that shows up in our life. And so then because we know those signs, then we know the truths we have to reground ourselves in to move forward from the inside out. And then we can start to identify practices we can put in place to start finding our way. And a lot of that practical wisdom she gave in the four directions has some practices of, you know, whether it's like figuring out your mission statement, figuring out your plan B, like there's some actual practical things you can do to help you start moving forward. And then think about, what support do I need to do that? Who do I need to pull in and talk to about what this looks like for me and what I need? Any questions? All right. Well, thank you guys so much.